Real Estate for Breakfast podcast, and I'm your host, Philip Coover. The Real Estate for Breakfast podcast is a Chicago-centric commercial real estate podcast utilizing attorneys and real estate professionals to create thoughtful commentary on current real estate issues, helpful descriptions of common legal and business issues, and entertaining discussion. We should start by mentioning that the podcast is hosted by SATC Solutions Center, L3C, the Educational and Development Division of the law firm Shankanis Tepper Campbell. You can reach us by contacting us at realestatebreakfast.com, and you can find all of our contact information on that website. So we have two exciting things to cover today. We are going to have our featured guest, which is Stephen Spinell of JLL, and he has come on to talk about JLL's build-to-suit division, which I bring up because you're going to laugh because I called it a build-to-suite division throughout the entire interview, and he was kind enough not to correct me. So I thought he was a gentleman about it, and I thought that I would just say that off the top if that's distracting. But then Stephen is also a former professional hockey player, and he talks about his new endeavor to try to help educate and work with athletes as they transition from the competitive sporting world to the corporate world. And it's a fascinating discussion. He's got an excellent program and initiative that he is trying to push forward. But before we get to that, I'd like to talk to you about cybersecurity. And I have John Campbell, who's one of my partners here at Shankanis Tepper Campbell. John, say hello.
Good morning, Phil. Hello, everyone.
And John is here because we have a seminar coming up, or a symposium.
That's correct, Phil. It's going to be on cybersecurity, as Phil said, and really what it's addressing is for businesses and what does cybersecurity mean for your business.
So I thought John would be great to come on because John's our compliance officer, he's one of our transactional attorneys, and he's also spearheading our cybersecurity practice. So I know that everyone out there hears about cybersecurity all the time, but I thought it'd be worthwhile to talk about why is this important to us. John, why should, let's just take real estate companies because that's the focus of the podcast, but this probably applies to a wide range of businesses. But why should people care about cybersecurity?
Well, there's a number of important reasons why people should care about it, especially for businesses of all types, including real estate. One, you want to have customer trust. If your customers don't believe that the information that they're providing to you is secure, you're not likely going to get their business. Number two, cyber attacks, data breaches, they're on the rise. We've seen it from the recent presidential election all the way down to law firms being attacked, to real estate companies getting warnings from the FBI saying that they're seeing an uptick in certain locations. Down to just the mom and pops. Everybody is going to be vulnerable, just the nature of being online. But there are safeguards that we can all take, some inexpensive, some very easy, some a little bit more complicated, a little bit more expensive. But we can all take at least a certain measure of protection that we should be applying in our practice, whether it's real estate or outside, to give us a little bit more comfort as to what we're doing and how we can protect that information and how we can actually make this a more economical approach for everyone in the long run, because if you are hit with a cyber attack or data breach, it can be extraordinarily costly just to restore whatever information that was lost or what is taken. And that endeavor alone can be outpriced most businesses, but then when you look at the loss of reputation and the attack on your reputation for being someone who couldn't be able to secure that information, the losses really multiply significantly over a long period of time, because that bad reputation is going to be a stigma for most businesses that they may not ever recover from.
So if I'm, let's just say I'm a small brokerage company, and you see the brokers, they're out there with their handheld devices and they're firing off emails at an incredibly rapid rate just to keep up with their businesses. Why should, what's their if you're talking to these businesses, what would be their concern? What would happen if there is a data breach?
Well, it depends on the type of information that's lost. Would be the major factor that you would have to look at, and there's a number of ways where, maybe let's take a step back. Let's look to see what is a loss.
Yeah.
Loss can be a number of different things. Probably the easiest thing that most people don't really think about, and actually probably the biggest representative case here, is just losing a mobile device, whether it's your cell phone, laptop, or tablet. Those usually contain a huge source of your business information and your client information, whether it's stored in emails, stored in other data files that may be on the hard drive. That's probably the number one source that you're going to want to look to protect, in addition to your company's network and mainframe and all of those items. And that's an easy thing to protect. I forgot your question, Phil. Can you repeat what it was?
Yeah, so if I'm just a small brokerage firm and I'm just local here in Chicago, why do I need to worry about this? Who is out there trying to get my data?
Well, I will say this, from a real estate company's perspective, you would want to be careful, because usually the information that is desired isn't necessarily maybe your company's information, but it's your client's information. If there is a transaction that you're involved with, some of these sophisticated cyber hacks and attacks, what they do is they try to disguise themselves as being someone part of a transaction, and they give out false bank routing information and wire transfer instructions, and call and say, hey, we need to get that wire transfer of X number of dollars out. And it's, instead of going to the title company like you thought it might be, or going to a purchaser or a seller as you might think it's going to, instead what's happening, it's going to this third party who is basically effectively scammed the system and made you believe that that was an appropriate account to send it to. That's actually on the rise in a number of states where we've seen this come up, and the FBI has actually provided warnings recently on that, just for all real estate professionals and attorneys to be aware of, that this is a known issue, and it's a very sophisticated scheme, because what they're doing is they're going to your company's website and looking at information and logos and mimicking that in a false email. And then they're going to other social media sites to see, you know, the higher executives in a company who maybe didn't lock down that social media site. And, you know, if there's a person who's on vacation, they'll gather, you know, some information there to make it sound like a plausible story. Hey, this is Joe Smith, and I am the president of the company. I'm currently on vacation in Wisconsin with the family, but we really need to get this transaction done. I need you to wire this amount to this bank, and here's the following wiring instructions. And they send that email to a mid to low level employee who has the ability and capability of making that wire transfer, who may not know to verify the source of that email, especially if it looks like a legitimate source, especially if it's coming from one of the higher executives. So that's one of the reasons why you want to safeguard if you're a small mom and pop. The other reason is, if you do have a data breach and it is a loss of personal information, you're going to have to start contacting everybody. You're going to have to figure out how to stop that data breach if it's an ongoing breach and an ongoing attack. And then you have to look to see what you need to do to recreate your system if that was somehow jeopardized within the attack. One of the other things that people are doing is that they are breaking into the systems and holding that information hostage and seeking a ransom from companies.
Right.
So if you are locked out of your system, you're going to incur significant costs. I don't recall the exact figure, but it was an alarming number of small businesses that go out of business after a significant data loss. It's more than half. I don't remember the precise number, but it is more than half.
Well, that's terrifying stuff, especially the ransomware, where they'll just hold your data hostage, then you have to pay them money. And I recently read that there's also the new ransom worm, where it's a ransomware, but it's also a worm that will go from one computer to another within a network. And so it can hold multiple computers hostage, and then it stays in your computer. So even if you pay the ransom and they release it, there are little triggers left in the computer where couple months down the road it will just reactivate. Now they already know that you're willing to pay. It it's pretty terrifying stuff.
It is, and the other terrifying part of it, even if you do pay, not all the time do they release that information back to you. Or sometimes what they do is they release that information, and then down the road they will release that information to the public, so you just paid for more or less nothing. Or even worse, sometimes what they do is that, similar to what you were just talking about, once they can break into that network, they will continue to observe what's going on. And then if you have any critical information for a law firm, one of the top areas that they try to attack law firms is with mergers and acquisitions, with especially any of these high-end transactions. It's far easier to go to a law firm to attack that transaction, because usually we're getting the more of the nitty and gritty of the agreements and information, instead of it being, you know, one of the Fortune 500 companies that may have, you know, millions upon millions upon millions of documents for them to try to scan through to find the one thing or two things that pertain or pertinent to that transaction that they might have an interest in. So as a law firm, that's where we're vulnerable. But the same is true for real estate companies. When they are involved with a high-end transaction, that's where they're usually going to want to look first, too. Any information that they could potentially turn around and sell on the third market, whether it's disclosing information regarding a sale that would be harmful to a company, that could be where the seller doesn't want to disclose that they're starting to liquidate certain locations, whether it's because they're trying to right the course or stay out of bankruptcy, that could be really jeopardizing to the potential seller and their reputation if you let it out. And as a real estate professional, you also are going to owe certain fiduciary obligations to protect their information. So you could be jeopardizing both a monetary value to try to restore your client's loss, but potentially as a licensee, you could be jeopardizing your professional license as well, if the real estate commission doesn't believe that you held your minimum threshold as to protect that information.
Scary stuff. So let's talk for a second about the symposium coming up, because this cybersecurity first came on my radar about a year and a half ago, when John started really harping on everyone in our firm and everyone around us that we need to start to protect this data. I mean, my impression is that 10 years ago, there were only a couple hackers out there, and they were only targeting really big, really important companies. And so most of us could go about our daily lives thinking no one will ever try to hack us. But now there's so many hackers, and it's done through machines, and it's done through computer programs. And because of the increase in their abilities, and the increase of the data that we're all storing, it's just become a much higher risk and something that could threaten all of our companies. So we've set up this seminar on March 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. That's free. So go to our website, realestatebreakfast.com, and then there's a link right on it. There's actually a link directly to the website. Do you happen to remember that link?
I don't off the top of my head.
Well, realestatebreakfast.com will be better, because we'll draw you to the podcast website anyway. And there's a link right there for the seminar registration. And look for our email newsletter information about it. And we hope that you'll join us on March 8th, because we're going to go through some practical tips about how you can protect yourself and your company from this growing threat. I mean, we just thought that it would be good for all of us to get in a room and say, hey, this is a real problem. This is a risk for all of our companies. Let's all talk about what we can do without breaking the bank to do it. And we're going to have an insurance professional from the Horton Group to talk about cybersecurity insurance. And then from Peterson Associates, a guy who's more on the tech side, to talk through what we can do to protect ourselves. Then obviously we'll discuss the legal side.
Absolutely, Phil. And I think that really kind of hits the nail on the head. One of the things that has really come out over the last year and a half, 2 years, is that there is a common misperception that cybersecurity rests solely with an IT department or IT professionals. While that is a very critical component, that's only really about a third of it. The other two components that you really need to look at is insurance today. You have to look to see, one, is available, two, is it cost effective for you to procure appropriate insurance in the event of a cyber attack or data breach. And then the last component, which is really the important one, and I've been was told this by a gentleman over at the Horton Group that I met with about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and that just stuck with me, is that right now cybersecurity is moving a little bit out of IT and into the boardroom. And what that means is that your executives need to understand the importance of what the risks are if we don't protect this information and what we can do to start protecting it from a non-IT perspective or in addition to that IT perspective. And mostly that comes down to having solid policies in place that employees are to follow regarding mobile devices, securing information, password policies that are strong enough to protect the devices that aren't easy to hack. The number two part, the second component of that is that you want to make sure that there's adequate training of the employees, and it's not just a one training session. It has to be very repetitive. The information on this is changing almost on a daily basis, so you want to check in with them, let them know what the current threats are when you see something new, especially if it applies to your industry, to make sure that they're aware of it, and two, to make sure that they are following the policies that you had already put in place. And the third component is making sure you have a plan in place in the event that something does go wrong. It's going to be far more cost effective if you have an idea as to what you need to do in the event of an attack. It's whether it's knowing local law enforcement officials that you may want to reach out to, having the immediate contact information from either in-house or third-party IT providers, and then you're also going to want to have a consultant that can help you furnish that information in a way that it will advise your clients as to what's going on, but not create any undue or unnecessary concern for them. You need to notify them, but you don't want to scare them off either. So that's really the last component that's also critical, is just making sure you have a plan in place as to what you do in the event you are attacked.
Well, thank you so much, John. And if you want to hear more about the practical tips for how to implement these procedures and set them up for your company and protect your company, then come to our cybersecurity symposium on March 8th from 3 to 5 p.m. And you can sign up for that on our website, realestatebreakfast.com. There is a separate link, or there's a separate tab that you can click on that to sign up for our seminar registration, which and please feel free to check out our other educational opportunities at the Solution Center, SATC Solution Center L3C website, which is tied to the realestatebreakfast.com website. Thank you so much, John.
You're welcome, Bill. Thank you.
And please stay tuned for our interview with Stephen Spinell of JLL. This is Real Estate for Breakfast podcast, and I'm joined today by Stephen Spinell, who is with the Occupier Development Services team of JLL, which has been recently renamed to Build the Suite Practice Group, and they specialize in office headquarters, Build-to-Suite transactions. The team guides clients through all aspects of unique real estate transaction, from site selection to move-in. Stephen earned his BA in finance from Miami University's Farmer School of Business in Oxford, Ohio. He is a University of Miami alum, and he's also a former professional hockey player. So that's going to tie in, because we had Stephen on because Stephen and I met a few weeks ago, and has this passion project about helping young athletes in their transition to the corporate world and to life after hockey. And it's a fascinating story, and I think you'll find it really interesting. So I was immediately taken by that, wanted to get him in on the podcast, and I thought that we would start, though, since this is a real estate podcast, we'd start by talking about your work with JLL. So how long, Stephen, have you been with JLL?
Just a few days ago. It was a year exactly. It's been great. Very fortunate. I joined John Mushard, Ben Erskine, and Dan McCarthy's team. All those guys have been great mentors. you know, kind of ask for a better group to join. Our primary focus is in the suburbs. I'm starting on the north suburbs with Dan McCarthy. But then, as you mentioned, we have the Build-to-Suit Practice Group, which the most recent project was the Zurich Insurance North American headquarters in Schaumburg. Ended up being about a 750,000 square foot build-to-suit. It's a pretty amazing space.
That's an enormous project, 750,000 square feet. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple thousand employees, state-of-the-art. It's really something. If anyone ever gets the chance to get out there, they should go check it out.
It's worth their time. So let's talk about so it used to be called the Occupier Development Services Team, and now it's called Build to Suite. Tell us about that change.
So Occupier Development Services, the name itself is sometimes difficult to figure out.
Yeah, I was researching a little bit in preparation. I was trying to figure out what an occupier is. But I think I understand what a build-to-suit practice group is very easily.
Yeah, a build-to-suit is it's definitely more straightforward, and that's exactly what the group does. In short, build-to-suit projects are extremely complex and risky for a company to undertake, and our team maintains control and gives the company transparency throughout the whole process. We have one leader in charge of all work streams, and this kind of brings unprecedented visibility to scope and funding options when we use the capital market resources within JLL as well. Currently, we are the only team that can have this title and has the experience. Not only have we done the Zurich Insurance project in Schaumburg, we also consulted on Cologne, Germany, European headquarters for Zurich. Did a 1.2 million square foot redevelopment for Navistar in Lyle.
Wow.
And that's just a couple of many others across the country.
So the companies come to you and they have specific requirements for their real estate footprint, and so they need somebody to develop their area just for them rather than try to find an existing space and try to pigeonhole, push a square peg through a round hole or however that phrase goes.
Yeah, exactly. So oftentimes companies that we are working with, they're either outgrowing their current space and there's nothing in the market that can suit their needs, or they are just in a dated building and they need to get up to speed. They want to rebrand their image to attract and retain talent, and building something that's yours any way you want it, it's pretty appealing.
So you guys act as the developer, or like what's your role? And so tenant comes to you, company comes to you, they say, we need to develop this certain space and we want to hire JLL. And do you guys find the space and then hire the necessary companies to build it out the way it is? You help them get the architects? And what is your role in the process?
So we do all of that. Our role is to coordinate and maintain all those different workflows. And through the process, we bid out every part of the project. So architects, the work gets bid out. The contractors, the work gets bid out. And we run each part of that in order to then provide the best price to our client.
Well, that's nice that they have just one person to go to. I mean, anybody who owns a home, I'm a new homeowner in the past year. And you know, if you're trying to paint the living room and just put up some new lights in the bathroom, and you've got a leak in the upstairs, and you have to hire all these different people, and you don't want to just want to hire the first person. You want to talk to a few of your neighbors, get a few referrals. It ends up being an extremely time-consuming process. So I would imagine for a company that is not a developer or a company that doesn't do construction management, they just want to hire one company, just one contact, so just pick up the phone, and then you guys take care of bidding everything out, doing the due diligence to get a good contractor. I could see that being a very appealing option.
Yeah, that's exactly the process.
Well, Stephen, I mean, not to just jump right into it, but I'm really interested in talking to you about your passion project, because it's very interesting. what you're trying to do in your off real estate time. But just tell us a little bit about your hockey background.
So I grew up in Chicago, played hockey with local AAA, is the level they would call it, Team Illinois. Actually, I left home after my sophomore year of high school to go play in the USHL, which is the Tier 1 junior league before you go to college. It's a common path for guys on that path.
Where did you go for that?
I actually spent my junior year of high school in Hilliard, Ohio, a city outside of Columbus. Unfortunately, that team folded, and we got moved to Fargo, North Dakota, where I ended up graduating from Fargo South High School.
That's quite the transition. Think you're gonna be in Ohio, close to home. All of a sudden, you're in Fargo.
Yeah, it was. When I got that news, I was not too excited, but it ended up being one of the best hockey experiences of my life.
Well, I was gonna say that's the good news. You can just really focus on hockey when you're in Fargo.
That's about it.
And then where'd you go after you graduated from high school?
So after high school, I went straight to Miami of Ohio. I was playing hockey there, you know, got a Division I scholarship, played 4 years, got my degree in finance, and then was fortunate enough to play a few years in the professional ranks after that.
Actually, can we go back really quick? Because I was just thinking about this high school experience. So if you're playing for the juniors league and you're going to high school, how does that work? What kind of burden is that on your time? Do you go to high school in the normal time frames that most people go to high school and then play hockey after? Does hockey become a greater component of your time?
That's a great question. Usually what happens is when a team is in the USHL, is in a certain town, they have to coordinate with the high schools, and they pretty much come up with a condensed schedule for us. We don't get a study hall, we don't get a lunch, some of those off periods, and we just go class after class. We do get out early, so it gives us time to get to the rink for practice. It's not uncommon in that league for guys to be out of high school, but before college, trying to earn a college scholarship. So you can have anywhere from 16-year-olds to 21-year-olds on a team.
Really?
So some guys are doing it full-time, no schooling.
Right. And then you do it, do you do the high school full year round?
Yeah, high school schedule stays the same, just your day-to-day is different from the normal student.
All right. So now we're going to Miami University, which I also really enjoy. My wife is an alum. It's a beautiful school. People should go look at it. Just drive through if you haven't seen it. It is a gorgeous place. But how did you enjoy your experience there?
That was a few of the best years of my life, no doubt. It was great that I had family there the whole time. Some might say that's not a great thing, but we're a pretty close-knit family. At one point, my older sister, younger sister, and younger cousin and I were all at the school together, which provides for some special family time.
Sure.
Especially with other family coming in and visiting on the weekends for games. It was a family reunion almost every other weekend.
Well, that is really cool. So you guys won the league championship in Miami.
Yes, we did that a few times. We were the first team at Miami to win the playoff championship. And while I was there, we won the league championship two times.
And then also, I shouldn't say that, I mean, that we only met in person a few weeks ago, but I do know a lot of your family, and I did see you play at Soldier Field.
Yeah, that a couple funny of years enough, ago. That was the first time I was ever at Soldier Field was when I was playing hockey on the field. I'd never been to a game before.
I don't know if anybody else could ever say that. You might be the only person that's ever said that.
I think
that.
So.
Can make that claim. So while you're in hockey, while you're playing hockey in Miami, what is the difference between, and the reason why we're going through these steps is because it leads up to the kind of impact that playing competitive sports has on a young academic, on a young scholar. So what kind of time commitments did you have to playing your sport as opposed to school? Because, you know, a lot of college students have a lot of free time. They have a lot of time to themselves and to their studies, but I don't think that's the case with someone playing competitive sports.
It's definitely not the case. Every day we had a time block from 1 to 4 o'clock where that was time at the rink. And 1 o'clock means you need to be at the rink at noon to prepare. And so from there, you have to schedule your classes around that. It means you're taking early morning classes and you're taking classes at night. Your days are nonstop, getting from class to class to the rink, getting showered, making it to your next class, and then mixing in time to eat and do your work. The day-to-day, if you fall behind, you can stay behind for a while. And then you have to deal with traveling almost every other weekend. Luckily, most of these conferences, the travel isn't too far, but if you need to get on a bus from anywhere from 4 to 8 hours, it's a lot of time leaving school early and traveling on Sundays.
Sure, I'm sure that's extremely difficult. And some people might say, well, the kids can study while they're on the bus, but that is not an ideal atmosphere, you know, to understate it a little bit, to study. I mean, it's, even if everybody was quiet and behaving themselves, that would be a challenge to study while in transit like that. So after college, what happened after you graduated?
So I was able to sign a contract in the Boston Bruins organization, where I went and played in the American Hockey League with the Providence Bruins. And I also spent some time in South Carolina with their other affiliate team. That next year, I was able to sign a contract with the New York Rangers organization. And I spent that entire year in Hartford, Connecticut, playing in the American Hockey League, which is around here, the Chicago Wolves is
right,
the equivalent. You know, unbelievable experience, met a lot of interesting people and
sure,
a lot of good times.
I'm sure. And then what we're leading up to is, how is your transition to corporate life? When did you decide to hang up the skates and move on?
So leading into my third year, I was supposed to be in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in Detroit Red Wings system. Went to training camp, and how things were sifting out, I was not on the trajectory that I wanted to be on for continued growth and the eventual dream of playing in the NHL. It's a dream that became a goal, and you know, you're within reach, and you know, the reality was it wasn't going to happen for me. And that was when I decided I had to switch gears and start planning, I guess, for the rest of my life, my next career, kind of chasing that next championship in the sports sense. Was not an easy decision, and I was lucky that I had friends and family in Chicago. I grew up here. Mm-hmm. My now wife is also from the area, and so family was in Chicago, so that was a natural landing point.
Right.
Because we've been here, I was able to tap into a network of people just to start having coffee with somebody to learn about their path. And I found that to be invaluable. There's a few people that early on I met with that really helped shape the direction I would take next. But yeah, it's not an easy time. And that's part of my passion project.
Right. I mean, I think that you had a couple things going for you, like you had a BA of finance from Miami University, and I'm not saying that's something you earned while you were there, but I'm sure it was challenging for you to do that transition. But talk about people besides just you, about athletes in general who have realized that they need to transition to a different career.
I think that's difficult. Athletes spend, you know, almost their entire life completely dedicated to their sport. While in college, most times the summers are filled with training. There isn't that same time that other students might get to go out and get internships and to kind of experience different parts of the business world or different types of companies. So, you know, players, it's tough to change your mindset when your whole life you're chasing your dream, you're giving, you know, mind, body, and soul to your game, and then to deal with the reality that no matter what, no matter even if you become an all-star in the game, that there's going to be life after that sport. It's tough to get yourself there and to prepare for that type of thing, even though I think it could be the most important thing you ever do.
Right. I mean, even the best player, like you're just saying, will eventually phase out into a different part of their life and their career. And some people's are, it comes sooner than others. And seems, and also I've heard you talk about how the mental challenge of all your life you've been taught just push a little harder, work a little harder, and you'll get there. And for the people that actually are playing college competitively in the minors, in the pro leagues, that actually has worked. It has panned out. The harder they've pushed, the more they've dug down, they have gotten better and they have reached the next level. And then all of a sudden, there is no more next level. So that brings us to your project. So what are you trying to do now to help deal with that issue and help people transition?
So when I was going through my transition, again, I mentioned I was fortunate to have a network of people I could lean on. And I quickly realized that was not the case for everybody, not at all. I had teammates in similar shoes I was in who were just struggling, really struggling, some moving across country to start their life with a girlfriend or, you know, fiance, and not knowing anybody in the area, and sending in numerous job applications online because they don't know anybody. And there's ways I found that you can navigate this part of life in order to set yourself up, you know, through networking and just putting yourself out there a little bit.
Sure, sure. Well, do you want to talk about some of those ways?
Sure. You know, I learned that the best thing you can do early on when you're in college, even if you don't want to take your mind off your game, you need to. You need to get lunch, grab a coffee with anyone that will give you their time, and just learn how to ask the right questions. Become genuinely curious about that person. Figure out what makes them tick, because when you get someone talking about what they like and what fuels them, it's very easy to see what you can see yourself in them. And from there, you can formulate your own path of the type of work you might be interested in, when previously all you cared about was throwing a football or taking a slap shot. That would be one piece of advice I think is so important, is to be genuinely curious about other people's livelihoods.
That's excellent. But I mean, that applies to everything, really. I think that that's excellent. I love the way you phrase that. And I think that's a good lesson, especially because I would imagine that some of these athletes who've been so focused, and maybe they haven't, let's just say, paid as much attention to the academic portions of their schooling while they've been going through high school, college, they've been focused a little bit more on the sports, they may just get to a place, I'm thinking about you just saying people moving across the country and applying places, they may not have any idea what they're applying for or where their skills might lie or what type of job they would want to do. So I like your idea of just talking to people throughout the process, throughout your life, and when you find yourself looking for a place, just talk to people about what they're doing, because you might have 10 conversations and there might be one or two people who say, hey, you know what, I kind of want to do that. Like, I like what that person's doing, and that might be something I'm interested in. So I think that that's great advice.
Yeah, it's. I hope it can be helpful. I found that the athlete mindset, as you go through and, you know, you're a leader on your team, whether it's high school or college or pro, you have fans that come to your games, and you're used to, you know, people kind of praising you for, you know, what you've trained to dedicate your life to and the game that you love. And when you have to switch gears and you have to become interested in someone else, when you're used to people showing interest in you just because you're that athlete, it's a different mindset. And it's not bad. It's a different mindset that I think some athletes are not aware of. And if they are aware of it, it's tough to acknowledge it and understand that hurdle.
Sure, sure. Well, do you have any other advice?
The other piece of advice I would give to any athlete out there and to any student, period, is when you're going through school, if you can find the time to get an internship, but do it in a field that you think you have no interest in, or you might have some, but you don't know anything about it.
Interesting.
When you're in school, you have time, you can make mistakes, figure things out. You know, if you're familiar with a certain industry, if your dad was a lawyer, it's very easy to become interested in law. Mm-hmm. But I would challenge you to go out and get an internship with a banking institution or a real estate company and just learn to see, one, it'll do two things. It'll either confirm your interest or it will allow you to check the box of something you do not want to do.
Yeah.
And both are equally valuable in my opinion.
Right. That's the basis, the underlying basis of most science is just to eliminate options. And it's not always about finding the answer. It's about eliminating things that are not the answer until you narrow it down. That's really interesting advice. I like that. So let's talk about the transition game. That is the name of your venture, and it's something that you obviously care a lot about, these athletes. I'm sure there's a lot of personal relationships, people you know that you care about their transitions, and so you have good advice for athletes going through this stage of their career. What is the next step for the name of your company, the Transitions Game?
So yeah, that's the name we land on, the Transition Game. We kind of feel that applies across any sport and for anybody, any stage of life. You're constantly in different transitions.
It's a great name.
And thank you. And so it's about navigating that and not looking at the next phase of life without sports or without the game that you love as a second place trophy. Not looking at the next stage with fear and anxiety, but being able to create awareness, provide support, and teach certain life skills to these athletes early on so it becomes second nature and they can develop their own roadmap to walk down any path they want. That's kind of the essence of what we're trying to do, create that awareness.
So do you think that you'll try to go to colleges and work with colleges to help their young athletes and sort of be kind of like a life mentor, or just to open up their eyes, really, like you're saying, awareness, build awareness to other options, other careers besides what they're focused on?
Yeah, to have those opportunities would be amazing. Right now, the focus I have is with Miami Hockey and Miami Athletics. That's where my heart is.
Yeah, it's a natural fit.
You know, we're just working on there, and we'll see where it goes from there. But starting with Miami, I think, is a natural fit. The next step is really we're creating a platform where we can facilitate, let's call it these coffee meetings, where guys can know whether it's past Miami Hockey alum, Miami Athletic alum, or Miami alum in general. There would be a landing point where current athletes can go into the system and find these different alumni and through the system schedule time on their calendar, 15-minute, 20-minute conversation, and just pick their brain. Ask those questions, become genuinely curious of that person to help them think outside of kind of the bubble they're in with their sport.
Well, I think that's fantastic what you're doing. It's obvious how much you care about it. Is there any other aspects of the transition game you want to talk about here today?
I think a big component to make it work is really about kind of creating a community and a network of people that are willing to give back. I've always been a proponent of, you know, once you get to where you think you're going, to turn around and help the next guy.
Absolutely.
And I know I'm early in my career now in real estate, but as far as my hockey career, you know, I dedicated 20 solid years of my life to it, and I, some would say I achieved some success there. And I'm looking at this as instead of teaching kids how to skate or how to shoot a puck, I want to enable kids to not be fearful of what's next and to empower them to know that they can really do anything.
Right, and it's not a second place trophy, as you say. It's just a different career. There are different things, and you can still conquer these other careers, and you can be champions in other ways that might bring more satisfaction to their lives than hockey even did.
And that's exactly the vision.
Well, I also love that you're willing to give back and try to help these younger kids who've been on the path. That's just a good philosophy. Those who give shall receive. And is there anything else that you wanted to cover today?
I mean, I think that's pretty...
Pretty much
we're kind of off script now, but...
Well, yeah, no,
yeah, no I know,
yeah,
I know.
Editing software.
Yeah, I think it's pretty solid.
Where are we on time?
About 30 minutes.
See, I think that's good. Like, you start getting to 45 an hour, you got people tuning
Traveling,
out.
Yeah.
Like, you just want to hit the concepts. If somebody's interested, here, let's just wrap it up. Stephen, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming in and telling us about the Build to Suite practice group at JLL and your work there. I think that's an interesting endeavor that JLL is getting into, and I think that there's a lot of value there for people who are looking for that kind of representation. And then I also appreciate you coming to talk about and explain your story and to share that with all of us and to explain what you're working on and trying to help these younger athletes. And I would encourage anybody who's out there listening to get in contact with Stephen. He's going to be reaching out and trying to build this platform and trying to help these people, and I'm sure he could use help.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me on the show, and you know, it's a really great opportunity, and I appreciate that.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Real Estate for Breakfast podcast. We look forward to seeing you again in 2 weeks. If you want to get in touch with us, just email us at solutioncenter@satcltd.com or visit our website, realestatebreakfast.com. Thanks so much, and look forward to having breakfast with you soon.
Nothing contained in this podcast shall constitute financial, investment, legal, or other professional advice. No professional relationship of any kind is created between you and the podcast host or guests. You are urged to speak with your own financial, investment, or legal advisors before making any investment or legal decisions. The opinions expressed in this podcast are not necessarily the opinions of the SATC Solutions Center or Shankanis Tepper Campbell or any of its employees. This podcast is created by the individual capacities of the host and guests. All opinions on this podcast are rendered based on specific facts and under certain conditions and subject to certain assumptions, and may not and should not be used or relied upon for any other purpose, including but not limited to, for use in connection with any investment purposes or legal proceeding.